Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Many of our problems today stem from the huge and growing gap in wealth and income inequality among Americans. Income inequality is so severe, it's making it nearly impossible for millions to live the American dream. This income inequality is not inevitable. It is the result of decades of policies passed that favor the very wealthy. What can we do about income inequality? Is it possible to reverse income inequality given the power of Wall Street in our government? What would a campaign to reduce income inequality look like? What is the solution to income inequality that can restore the American dream for all? Here to help us understand all this and more is Harold Meyerson, one of the country's leading political analysts. Harold Meyerson is editor-at-large of the American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country, where he has worked for 12 years. He also writes a weekly op-ed column for the Washington Post, where he's been a columnist for 10 years. From 1989 through 2001, he was executive editor of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. His articles on politics, labor, the economy, foreign policy, and American culture have also appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The Nation, and many other publications. Harold Meyerson, welcome back to All Together Now.
Always good to be here, Eleanor.
I love talking with you because you know a lot what's going on and you're still hopeful, so it's very inspiring.
Against all odds, yes.
Yes, exactly. Well, your recent article in the American Prospect, I think, is one of the best you've ever done. And you lay out a strategy there for how Democrats can win by breaking with Wall Street and standing for Main Street and policies that benefit the majority of Americans. So I'd like to start our conversation off with really explaining and exploring what your proposed strategy is. I'd like to start, just so our listeners know, about how do you see, what is the current state of the middle class in America? How bad is it out there?
Well, I mean, we've reached the point where the Republican candidates for president are now saying, gee, the middle class is being left behind the rich. I mean, that's essentially what Jeb Bush said in his speech to the Detroit Economic Club yesterday. So I think there is a growing consensus, which it's only taken, you know, decades to get most American elites to realize that a huge gap has opened between the wealthy and everyone else, and that it isn't that everyone else is gaining at a lower rate than the wealthy. It's that they are simply not gaining at all.
Yeah, that's very depressing. It's, you know, you're looking at the 30-year trend towards income inequality generally, but it seems to have been exacerbated with the Great Recession 2007. And if you look at who's recovered, the so-called recovery since then, is it true that, you know, virtually all of the income growth since the 2007 recession has gone to the top 10% income earners?
Actually, since the 2007, almost all of it has gone to the top 1%. Here are some figures, and these figures come from the foremost American collaborator with Thomas Piketty, the author of the now celebrated book Capital in the 21st Century, and that is Emmanuel Saez, who is a economics professor at Berkeley. And he and Piketty have essentially examined, they're able to now do data analyses of all the income tax returns, the numbers, not the names, since the income tax was instituted in the United States in 1913. And the very good economists at the Economic Policy Institute here in Washington have done some further research and analysis based on what Emmanuel Saez has found. And so here's what he's found. Here's what they found. From 1935 to 1980, so sort of the middle of the 20th century, All the new income, all the economic growth of an individual income from 1935 to 1980, most of it, 70% of it, went to the bottom 90% of the economy. So this is the period of broadly shared prosperity, which is also a period, particularly right after World War II, of American economic preeminence and the strength of the union movement. We often forget in our sort of Ozzie and Harriet images of the 1950s, although I know I'm dating myself by saying that. But anyway, we often forget.
We'll assume you know it from a history class, not from lived experience.
I don't know if they teach Ozzie and Harriet. Maybe they should. The 50s were supposedly this placid decade against which children of the 60s, such as myself, rebelled. But actually, there were a huge number of strikes in the 1950s, and this is the way workers essentially were able to raise their wages and incomes and create the great majoritarian American middle class, the sort of the economic marvel of the world. So, as I said, from 1935 to 1980, 70% of all the new income went to the bottom 90% of Americans, and only 7% went to the top 1%. Now, the analysis then looked at all the new income since 1997, and the findings are just breathtaking. Instead of getting 7% of all the new income in that period, the top 1% got 72%. That's not a typographical error or whatever the oral equivalent of that would be. 72%. The rest of it went to the 90th to 99th percentile. And the bottom 90% got precisely zero. In fact, they actually lost about $2,000 a head of income from 1997 to 2012, which is the last year for which the data are available. So we have a complete turnaround in the distribution of income in America. We have economic stagnation beginning at the 90th percentile. So the notion that, you know, Americans' problems can be fixed by better education, I think is called somewhat into question by that. Yes, better education is always a good, and it certainly helps, but the economic stagnation begins among people who are pretty well educated by any standard and works its way on downward. So that's essentially what we have in the United States today. And as you said in your introductory remarks, that's not the result of physics or the sun rising in the east, and there's nothing we can do about it. It's the result of a political choice and changing economics that can be affected by policy.
Right. You know, it's so striking when you talk about that period in the United States from 1935 to 1980, where the top 1% only got 7% of that wealth there, that is really the core time. When we talk about the great American century, that's when America pulled itself out of the Depression, fought and won World War II, and then had that explosion of growth and the expansion and strengthening of the middle class, and the wealthy also got even more wealthy. So really, everybody prospered. And in that stretch, only 7% of that income went to the top 1%. And now the top 1% is getting 72% of that income, and millions and millions of people are suffering. They've lost their homes, they're homeless, they've lost their jobs, or they have a job now, but instead of earning a decent wage in manufacturing or something, they may be flipping burgers at McDonald's. So, you know, it's just, you would think, you know, that you could recognize we do the best. America does best when we all do best. And right now, it's so stratified to the top 1%, it's really choking out a lot of the other people.
That's right. And, you know, there are a lot of things a nation can do when it's more broadly prosperous that are harder for it to do when people are suffering economically. It can probably address environmental issues better, when people have confidence about the economy and it's working reasonably well, and so it makes sense to do something like raise the gas tax or whatever. For better or worse, America's foreign policy and military policy becomes more doable, whatever it may be, if the American public is doing well enough to afford to fund whatever it is we are doing overseas. As I said, for better or worse, since that could mm-hmm. there's a checkered history of what we do overseas, and there's just a whole range of things. I mean, it's really not entirely a coincidence that the great civil rights revolution of the 1960s occurred at a time when most Americans were upwardly mobile and didn't feel economically threatened by the civil rights revolution. Obviously, a lot of folks felt threatened their in many cases racist assumptions, but it wasn't really an economic fear. And I would argue that the economic straits that many Americans are in now is one of the reasons we have sort of a nativist backlash against immigrants. There's a fear, which is not very well founded, that they're going to be pulling down wages, et cetera. Wages have been pulled down plenty, but no, not by immigrants. They've been pulled down by the changing behavioral patterns of American employers and American corporations and the pressure put on them by Wall Street.
All right. And you mentioned that the dramatic shift of the income wealth going really to the top 1% in such a huge way was the result of certain policies that we did. And rather than dwell on how bad that was and what shifted that went wrong, I'd like for you to talk about some of the policies you're recommending now that could actually reverse that income inequality. I mean, these things are not inevitable, consequences of capitalism or just happening by out of nowhere. That these economic situations are coming directly out of policies that have been pursued, I will say, by both parties. I mean, largely led by the Republicans, but the Democrats don't have their hands entirely clean on this. What are some of the policies you're recommending that we can be following now that would lead us to back to greater shared prosperity in the country?
Well, the fundamental shift in income is related much more than mainstream economists who are taught not to think this way, much more than they think, is related to fundamental shifts in power. David Rolfe, who heads the most successful branch of the Fight for 15 movement, he heads SEIU in Washington State and in Seattle, where the minimum wage, after a campaign that David was sort of the mastermind of, was raised to $15. David Rolfe likes to say that policy is frozen power. That policy reflects the relative power of different forces in society. So I would say to address the huge wealth and income disparities, we have to look at the disparities in power. So first of all, it's very hard to envision how you rebuild a middle class absent the union movement, which is, almost vanished from the private sector, which is really where it's economically critical. I mean, the new figures, annual figures come out every February from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and the new figures on the rate of unionization in the private sector is 6.6%, which is, almost a functional equivalent of zero. Since you don't have a lot of bargaining power when 93 out of 100 workers aren't unionized. So restoring workers' rights certainly is part of the picture. There are some people, Rich Kallenberg and Moshe Marvit, have written a book on this, who think that union organizing should be a protected category under the Civil Rights Act, because if you are found guilty of discrimination under the Civil Rights Act of 1964, there really are serious penalties and serious fines, whereas if you're found guilty of, if you're an employer violating the National Labor Relations Act, which has been the act under which labor relations has fallen since 1935, the penalties for, say, illegally firing a worker during an organizing drive are negligible. All you have to do is reinstate the worker, which is, you know, has become routine now as a way of thwarting workers' efforts to form unions in their workplaces. So that's one suggestion. But, you know, there's all kinds of fundamental power shifts that we have to address as well. And I would say the most fundamental of all, and what separates out, say, American capitalism from German capitalism, which is, you know, a form of capitalism which clearly at this juncture is doing a better job of preserving and creating broadly shared prosperity than ours is. The clear difference is the increasing power of major shareholders. That's really a major shift, and we see this in the ways in which corporations are jerked around and by I love the euphemism, activist investors who, you know, want them to hold down wages, lay off people, and do everything to increase the payout to shareholders. And so in recent years, we have seen the sort of amazing rise of something that corporations increasingly do, most of them do, called stock buybacks. What this is the corporation purchases its own shares, taking them out of circulation and thereby raising the value of the shares that remain, which is a benefit to shareholders. And it's also a benefit to CEOs, since most of them have their pay linked to the rising share value. And so it's really kind of a way a corporate chief executive can raise his own wages. And since the vast, vast, vast majority of them are male, that's why I said his. So what we find is that among the Fortune 500 corporations, and a very good economist at the University of Massachusetts, William Lozonik, did a very good study on this, among the Fortune 500 corporations over the last decade, all of them have directed amounts equal to more than 90% of their profits over the last decade, either to paying out dividends or to share buybacks. So that's 90% of their profits going to rewarding shareholders. At the same time, their corporate investment in America in research and development, which is a sort of thing that creates long-term prosperity, or, God forbid, raising employees' wages, which doesn't really happen very much anymore, we don't see that. And corporations are increasingly getting rid of workers and hiring them back as independent contractors, so they don't have to pay any benefits for them, and they're not subject to wage and hour legislation and things like that. So we have this massive shift to shareholders under the doctrine, which a lot of folks believe was inscribed on the tablets that Moses brought down from Mount Sinai, but really were only propounded by Milton Friedman in 1978. The doctrine that the sole mission of the corporation is maximizing shareholder value. And a lot of corporations, major corporations, most major corporations, maximize shareholder value by holding down wages, in many cases holding down investment, shipping their profits overseas, so which is something Obama's budget proposes to deal with, not shifting their work overseas, shifting their profits overseas so they don't have to pay to tax shelter economies so they don't have to pay major taxes on them. Everything is to reward shareholders, but disproportionately, of course, the largest shareholders. And that, so this is this massive power shift to the largest shareholders, which is also fostered in legislation by, the tax on capital gains being far lower than the tax on income derived from work. And so on. So I think a lot of the question is, what do we do to reverse that shift. And here I think Germany is something of a model. For a variety of sort of odd historic reasons, Germany, which is an economy that's kind of like a combination of pre-modern capitalist or local capitalism of the early 19th century with social democracy of the 20th century, and it turns out that the combination of these two are doing very well in the 21st century. Germany has a system in which most corporate funding doesn't come from shareholders. It comes from its retained earnings. Of course, our corporations don't have retained earnings because they give them all back to the shareholders. And they have to, by law, divide the corporate board of directors between management shareholder representatives, if there are shareholders, on the one side, and worker representatives on the other side, divide them equally. And what this means, for instance, is that, if German corporations are every bit as global as American corporations, Siemens and BASF and Daimler and Volkswagen, have facilities all over the world. So they're not, they're as much affected by globalization as we are. But because of the power of worker representatives on their corporate boards, they keep the most high value-added jobs, the best-paying production jobs and such, at home in Germany, which is quite the opposite of what most American corporations that have gone globe-trotting have done. So I think you have to find a way, and I can get to that in a minute after I catch my breath, you have to find a way to incentivize this kind of equalization of power relationships, I think, within business structures if we're going to get to a more less inegalitarian distribution of income and wealth. And so the question is how to do that.
Right. Well, that's a very fulsome answer to the question of how do we reverse income inequality and promote shared prosperity. And I think that combination of really the focus on shift on power, that we need to restore workers' rights, which would be great. Things that strengthen unions, of course, would help. But, I think there's other things we can do, too, where if in the absence of unions, then it could come down to the city councils or mayors or governors or even the federal government, if it can rouse itself to do things like increase minimum wage, do things that would, the paid sick leave, do things that would have been advocated by the unions when they were stronger, but they don't have the strength now. So kind of number one.
Actually, the unions are advocating that. I mean, if you look at the campaign to, raise the minimum wage, it's pretty much sparked by the fast food workers movement, which is backed by the Service Employees International Union. In fact, there's an interesting almost definitional question as to whether that campaign is a success or not yet. Because, if the goal is unionizing McDonald's, I think by any estimate they're quite a long way from being able to do that. If the goal is raising workers' wages, heck, it has caused all kinds of cities and states, it has prompted them, it has highlighted the issue, sort of like in the way in which Occupy Wall Street did, but with more staying power. Raising the wage, and it's been successful in city after city and then in a number of states, even Republican controlled states. So the unions are playing a role, but I think before we get to the kind of laws that cities and states can pass, I do think there is something that we can do to affect corporate structure. Now, you can't do that obviously if there is a Republican controlled Congress, and it's an issue that Democrats haven't given a lot of thought to either, although there's the senior Democrat on the ranking Democrat on the House Ways and Means Committee, Chris Van Hollen, is certainly beginning to. And that is, look, there's this whole massive discussion of corporate tax reform. That's over here in one silo. And then in another silo, there's this whole discussion of economic inequality. But I don't see any reason why these have to be in two separate silos. So Chris Van Hollen has introduced a bill with the avid backing of Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi that notices that corporations can deduct their CEO's what's called a the CEO's productivity bonus. If you know, if the CEO's pay goes up because of performance, the performance bonus, I should say, which usually means that the stock price goes up, and so therefore the CEO can, in essence, pay himself $10 million a year. Corporations can deduct that if $9 million, if $9 million of that is the so-called performance bonus. So Van Hollen's introduced a bill which says that you can only do that if you give your all your workers a performance bonus. You know, under the theory that if a corporation's doing so well that the CEO gets a performance bonus, he probably isn't responsible, you know, for all of the things that are reflected in the corporation's good performance. There are probably other people involved as well. So I think that cracks the door open to my sort of larger idea, which is why don't, you know, so he would say, before we do that, Van Hollen's bill says, if you want to deduct that, you've got to give your workers a performance bonus, too, equal to the increase in the nation's productivity over the past year and a cost of living increase as well. Well, those are the two things that used to be reflected in good union contracts, most notably the United Auto Workers contracts in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So it's kind of legislating that, and it's keying the ability of corporations to make this deduction to their behavior there. But I would go further. I mean, not that this is, you know, going to pass in the foreseeable future, but I think it should be a good cause for progressives, and that is I would just key the whole corporate tax rate to whether they do that. You know, if we're so concerned, and we are now, I mean, even Jeb Bush is, about everyone falling behind the rich, I would, you know, scale corporate tax rates to whether they give their employees a performance bonus and a cost of living adjustment. I mean, you know, I don't see any reason why a corporation that does that shouldn't pay a lower tax than a corporation that doesn't do that. I mean, you could require it by law, too, but that's even beyond the realm of my fantasies. But scaling corporate taxes to that kind of corporate behavior strikes me as one of the ways you could really begin to deal with the fact that once unions got weak, employees no longer got increases in pay when their productivity increased. When productivity increased, all the benefit from that just went to the top management and the shareholders, disproportionately, obviously, the larger shareholders.
Right, exactly. Well, what? and that's where we have some enlightened legislators at the state and federal level can, you know, pick up where some of the unions have left off. Obviously, unions that are still here are advocating for the workers' rights and increases. But that now is going to have to be supplemented, enhanced, and carried by enlightened legislators who pass legislation just like what Van Hollen is talking about and your wonderful amendment to it.
Well, here's the thing. Here, right now, as we look at the United States and the balance of political power right now, there really are, you know, I mean, this stuff obviously has to start beneath the federal level, given you know, the composition of all the branches of the federal government right now. But there are only 7 states right now that have Democratic governors and Democrats in control of both houses of the legislature. And all of them, except our mega state, California, are really pretty small states. Indeed, the second largest is Oregon, to give you a sense of, you know, then we're into sort of the Vermont, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Delaware, Hawaii category. So a lot, you know, a lot depends on California, where there is a clear progressive majority and a complicated center-left governor named Jerry Brown, though they've done some very good stuff in California, that a lot of it under the radar in terms of making corporations responsible for workers in their supply chain, even if they're not directly employees, because really they are directly employees. But where the main opportunity is, and this is both a blessing and a curse, is at the city level. City halls are, at this point, overwhelmingly Democratic and increasingly progressive. Of the 25 largest American cities, I'm sorry, of the 30 largest American cities, 25 have Democratic mayors, which is the greatest partisan imbalance since I don't know when. I actually had someone try to, one of the interns here, try to figure this out, and we gave up. We couldn't find a time when the imbalance was that great. And it's because of, you know, who has moved into cities. They're not only where immigrants live, but where immigrants have roots and have organized, and minority groups have roots, and unions are disproportionately stronger, and so on. So you're seeing a bunch of minimum wage hikes and paid sick day legislation and things like that enacted in cities. This past December in San Francisco, it became the first city to enact a retail workers' bill of rights, which simply stipulates that retail employers need to give their workers 2 weeks advance notice on their schedule so they can do things like plan their lives, what day you're available to take your kid to childcare, for how long, when you can schedule your college classes, when you can schedule your doctor visits. And that's really low-hanging fruit. There isn't a reason now that San Francisco's done this why 30 other cities can't do this. So I think we're going to see a lot of pro-worker stuff coming out of many city halls in recent years. The only limiting factor, and it's a real limiting factor, is cities can change some of the rules of employer-employee relations within cities. They can't change fundamental labor relations. That's preempted by federal legislation, and they don't have a lot of money. So funding some of their more progressive initiatives is always a conundrum for cities, but it's the one level of American government where the will, anyway, is there.
No, absolutely right, and I was just attending the U.S. Conference of Mayors in D.C. the week before last and was very struck by the energy and vibrancy of the mayors from around the country and the kinds of things they're talking about to deal with income inequality and other issues in their territory. It was very inspiring and hopeful. When I was growing up, I know the Republicans were seen as the party of the rich and the Democrats were seen as the party of the working people and the middle class. And so I kind of carried that imprinting with me. And it was, I've been watching with the Republicans attacking the Democrats saying, well, you just care about the poor. And you're giving, we're working hard and paying taxes, and you're giving our money away to the poor. Of course, the Republicans are taking our hard-earned tax dollars and giving away to the very wealthy. But that's another story. But you identify a problem I hadn't really thought about, that where the Democrats have taken action to address income inequality, that set of issues, and two of the major initiatives have been Obamacare and immigration reform, which largely do help the poor or the working poor and not so much the middle class. So when I'm reading you talking about that, I said, well, maybe there's some truth to that Republican accusation that the Democrats are working for the poor and not so much the middle class.
Well, I would put it this way. The Democrats came out of the New Deal, which they crafted. And most of the legislators who were somewhere around your age or my age, your age being younger than my age, but nonetheless, grew up at a time when the middle class was doing pretty well in America by historic standards. And they began to focus, quite understandably and quite rightly, during the 1960s, on the people who had been left out of the great middle class prosperity for reasons of race or gender or whatever. I mean, and so this was an understandable focus to try to bring up the bottom third of the American economy, both legally with the Civil Rights Act and economically with parts of the war on poverty, relatively meager though it turned out to be, and enacting Medicaid in addition to Medicare, sort of based on a kind of a tacit and non-malicious understanding that the middle third of the American nation and the economy that wasn't racially discriminated against or suffering gender discrimination in quite the same way, that the middle third was doing all right. I think there's kind of a new realization at this point that the dividing line for those who need help and those who don't is a lot closer to the way the Occupy Wall Street movement framed it. We are the 99%. That doesn't mean the Democrats should abandon causes like immigration reform. They're absolutely morally, economically, politically, everything else, they're absolutely essential. But it means they need a broader program, too. It means they need a program that recognizes that the broad middle of the American population is in deep trouble that has its roots in the very structure of the economy. And, you know, we're beginning to see that movement now. And there's certainly some of it in President Obama's budget that he submitted on Monday, which, you know, calls for things like increasing a child care tax credit to $3,000 because, you know, the number of American families that have trouble finding and paying for quality child care is huge. Obviously issues like the affordability of college, which affects people way up the the socioeconomic ladder because it's grown so huge that Obama begins to address with the community college free tuition proposal. So I think there is a shift really just in sort of the broad understanding of who needs help coping with the new economy. It ain't just the poor. It's actually quite definitely a majority of the American people.
Right, exactly. And I think you hit it exactly right. It's not that we should forget or ignore the bottom third or those who are struggling most, but to expand the vision, expand the lens, expand the prosperity and the steps that we need to take across the broad middle. I mean, you just look at the class slippage of the millions of Americans who had been in the middle class and then slid down with the loss of a job or a health problem, a loss of their home with the craziness in the housing market since 2007, and not recovered. So there's a lot. We've got to really strengthen that middle class, or we're going to head into a terribly stratified economy by income and by wealth. So, you know, here for the broadly shared prosperity and what it's going to take for that. Now, the program you've laid out here, I think, is great, and you bring some more detail even in your article in the American Prospects issue this month. But as you rightly point out, many Democrats have been reluctant to wade into that territory that you talked about with the tax structure and corporate representation for workers and so forth. That many Democrats who are in office think they need the money from Wall Street to get elected. And why do you think that such a program as you're proposing could possibly pass in Congress, given the power of Wall Street?
Well, I mean, at the moment it can't, and even if the Democrats, it couldn't have passed even in 2009, 2010, when the Democrats controlled both houses. I mean, a lot of this is just structurally related to two things. First of all, the fact that the what used to be called the Rockefeller Republicans, the socially liberal or moderate Republicans, who clustered in the Northeast and were certainly well represented in Wall Street, largely have moved into Democratic ranks to a significant degree, repelled by the Yahoo-ism of the Republican base and the policies that follow from that. So there are a lot of Wall Street financiers who are major donors to the Democrats. And that's a structural problem for Democrats who want to make these kinds of progressive populist changes. The other problem, of course, is simply the flood of money into politics, and which can make you beholden to sectors of the economy and society that, in a better world, you really wouldn't want to be beholden to, or even don't want to be beholden to now. But there you are. There's been a bill introduced in the House by John Sarbanes, who is a congressman from Maryland, the son of Paul Sarbanes, former Democratic senator from Maryland, that would establish a kind of public financing system that probably would pass muster with the court, and that is already in effect in some cities, most notably New York, wherein a candidate who vows not to take contributions larger than a certain amount, in this case $1,000, can get any contribution of $150 or less matched by public financing at a 6-to-1 ratio, so that a contribution of $150 would be matched by $900 in public funds, totaling, therefore, in aggregate, $1,050. And it has a lot of co-sponsors. I think I have about 140 Democratic House members and one Republican, the maverick Walter Jones from North Carolina.
Hooray for Walter Jones.
Hooray for Walter Jones. It's not going to obviously even, you know, get out of committee given Republican control of the House. And it wouldn't be the sort of thing, that all the other Supreme Court decisions and laws are still standing, it probably wouldn't be the sort of thing that is adopted, and this is only for House candidates. I think there'd be an equivalent bill for Senate candidates in the Senate and so on, but it wouldn't be the kind of thing that would be invoked in closely competitive races, because millions of dollars pour into competitive House races these days, and, you know, that would be impossible for a candidate who took this pledge to match. But Sarbanes had a study done that showed that, you know, on average, you could raise more in this system than 77% of House members raised in the last cycle not using this system. And, you know, so many House members have non-competitive races, thanks to the miracle of both ideological clustering in neighborhoods and gerrymandering, that there's really no reason that most House members couldn't avail themselves of this. And it, you know, the small contributions, by the way, for the House members have to come from within your state. So, you know, you're really mm-hmm. Amazingly enough, financially dependent on your own constituents rather than
what a concept.
State lobbyists. I know. It's kind of a radical notion, you know. So I think it's a great idea. It you know, like I said, it's not a cure-all, and Sarbanes knows that, because you'd still have Citizens United, you still have Buckley v. Valeo, and all the decisions which have opened the floodgates for big money spending. But it creates an alternate mode of spending that most candidates in most districts could use and become less beholden to big money interests.
Yeah, I think that would be fantastic. And yes, you rightly point out, right now the House and the Senate have Republican majorities, so things about progressive tax reform are unlikely to make too much headway. But I do think you're right, and what I see you proposing here is a strategy that if the Democrats can really come out strongly for policies that really strengthen the middle class, that's really the pathway to success in the future. So we can hope that your recommendations find some hearing among the ranks of candidates, you know, running in 2016 and 2018 down the road. This is obviously kind of a multi-year strategy here. You mentioned about President Obama's budget, which just came out this week, and we all watched that State of the Union recently where it sounded like he had finally found his voice again. It was almost like the Obama of 2008 in the campaign was so strong and clear, and somehow he showed up in the White House, and then a lot of what he ended up doing didn't get us where we hoped we would go, but he seemed to find his voice again in this State of the Union. What do you think of the budget he released this week, and do you think he's going to be more of an ally for the middle class in the remaining 2 years of his presidency?
I like it, and yes, respectively. I think, one of the constraints he felt was needing to try to strike deals with the Republicans and more conservative Democrats during the last 6 years of his presidency. And now that Republicans are clearly in control, and it's quite clear that, save on a very discreet set of issues, no deals are there to be struck, he can actually say what he thinks is necessary. Which is clearly liberating for him, not just in a fiscal context. I mean, the decision about immigration, the decision about Cuba, all of this kind of almost you almost have a free at last is coming from the president in a way in which it wasn't in most of the time in his first 6 years. As to the budget, I think it's very good in a number of ways. First, in noting that the sequester, which nobody really was for, but was sort of the default position when they couldn't agree on any tax issues during the last stand-up, that the sequester is kind of crazy. Across the board whacking of the budget so that things that really need attention haven't been getting it. I like as I've mentioned, the whole sense that public support for education, complete public support for education, should go as high as it were as grade 14, that is the first 2 years of college, community college, not just grade 12 at high school, given the educational demands placed on workers, certainly the child care credit, certainly, and the tax stuff, which I don't think is particularly well understood. Raising taxes to pay for this by raising taxes, raising the capital gains tax, which is, as Warren Buffett has pointed out, the source of a tax that really only the major wealthy benefit from disproportionately, the low rates, and as Buffett points out, it's why he pays taxes at a lower rate than his secretary. I think that's important. And then dealing with the whole issue of corporations that make money overseas and keep it there, and even more precisely, corporations that make their money here and then send it overseas, just send the money overseas. To a tax haven other country like Ireland or the Bahamas. There's at least $2 trillion stashed overseas right now by Apple and General Motors. And what Obama is proposing is, if they're really making things over there, and therefore paying Belgian government tax, then they can deduct that from whatever tax they have to pay here. But if they're doing increasingly what American corporations, under the pressure from all these shareholder activist investors and others, is what they do, which is we're making our money here and then we're claiming we do a little business in Ireland or the Bahamas, or we're locating our patent registrations there, so that we can, really have to pay like no taxes on that. On that, he is saying, look, I'll lower the corporation tax like everyone wants. So from 35% to 28% is what he's proposing, or 25% for manufacturing firms. But if you're stashing money overseas, you've got to pay 14% tax on that right now, and 19% on an ongoing basis if you keep doing it. Which is really important. And then he says half of that money will be directed towards, shoring up the American infrastructure to, you know, roads, bridges that fall down, airports which look pretty shoddy and are pretty shoddy, all of the stuff we've neglected in the low-tax budget tightening of the past 3-4 decades. Will be addressed by this. I think that's really a very, very positive reform.
Yeah, there's a lot to like in President Obama's new budget here. And I noticed in your column today you wrote about Paul Ryan, the Republican chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, calling this budget envy economics. Why does he call it envy economics, and what's your response to Paul Ryan?
Well, you know, it's not just my response. We've talked about this. I was amused to see my friend E.J. Dionne, who's also a Washington Post columnist, also made this the subject of his Post column today. And E.J. and I have concluded that we need to have lunch together more often so we don't write the same column. But the standard Republican line is that the Democrats merely want to take, to hit the rich, punish them for being rich and using it for redistribution. Well, look, I mean, as I think those numbers I cited at the beginning of the show make clear, redistribution upward has been the focus of public policy for the past 40 years with disastrous effects on the American middle class. Should American workers envy Apple for the fact that it's able to pretend it does business in Ireland and thereby lower its tax rates? Well, maybe that's a form of envy, you know, because I'm sure American workers would be very happy to pretend they're Irish if they could get away with it, if it lowered their taxes. They can't, but Apple can. So, okay, I call that justifiable envy, you know,
right.
Or more really justifiable anger at the rich being able to evade taxes that everyone else pays. If that's envy, make the most of it.
Right, and as you point out, that's kind of the nature of what government does, is redistribute. It gathers taxes and then distributes it in various programs or funds, and, you know, the way it's been going, it's been redistribution up. How about we redistribute it more broadly now? So
sure. Well, EJ, actually, as long as we're EJ made a great point in his column that in his State of the State address, Republican governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, who is emerging as one of the front runners for the Republican presidential nomination, yesterday called for slashing the budget of the University of Wisconsin while he was proposing the state do a bond, a public bond, putting the state on, making it the state financially responsible for a new stadium for the Milwaukee Bucks basketball team. So EJ said, well, this is, redistribution from the Badgers, the teams of the public University of Wisconsin, to the Bucks, a private basketball team playing for profit. He said if that's Walker's idea of redistribution, he can have it. So, yeah, governments redistribute all the time, as EJ points out. And as you just said, the last 40 years, most of it has been going the wrong way.
Right. And, the austerity approach that is now kind of in favor in Europe, which is helping them all continue with stagnation for years longer than maybe they need to. It's interesting to note, going overseas for a minute here, that Greece just held an election where the candidate who was passionately opposed to austerity won. And the new government in Greece wants to trim their costs, yes, but at the same time stimulate government spending to create jobs and spur the economy, which is some of what could happen if Obama's budget here gets passed. As you say, you take the money from the offshore haven, the corporations, and redirect that to make sure our bridges don't fall apart and fix our roads. So now Greece has a strong president in favor of stimulating the economy, and the main obstacle is Germany. And you wrote an article recently saying Germany should remember their own history. Can you talk a little bit about what you think of the current Greek election and what's happening there in terms of its relationship to Germany?
Well, most of Southern Europe has experienced a miserable time of it since the 2008 crash. It wasn't actually as bad as the U.S. for the first year, but then because of the way in which Germany, through the European Union, enforced austerity on these nations, they've had a miserable time of it. Unemployment in both Greece and Spain has been at about 25% for years, which is, you know, the bottom of the depression in America in 1932 was that. Youth unemployment over 50% in both of those nations. Rate of poverty in Greece soared to over one-third, and there it remains. And, you know, the country's foreign creditors are insisting it continue to lower wages, cut the size of government, do everything to keep the economy depressed. And ironically, all of the loans that are, you know, going to Greece are being immediately repaid, you know, to former creditors and such, so that only about one-tenth of Greek debt actually goes to Greece. 90% of it goes to creditor nations and creditor banks. So it's really kind of an endless cycle from which Greece, Spain, to Portugal, Ireland, the debtor nations of Europe, really have nothing to show for it except poverty.
Right.
So I wrote a column last week.
We have 30 seconds to wrap.
Okay. So I wrote a column last week noting that creditor nations actually had cut in half Germany's debt in 1953. And, you know, I would think the same case should be applied to Greece. Otherwise, the entire European economy is going to continue to sag and at some point just tumble.
Right, and we should remember, you know, right now Germany is the main obstacle to Greece being able to do its kind of debt reform and stimulus spending, and little do they remember it was, the Marshall Plan that gave them the big boost up and their post-war recovery, which they're still singing along with. So
right, the Marshall Plan and debt forgiveness, just having their debt, which is, you know, Greece should be, hasn't even made a demand that radical. But Germany benefited from it in the early 1950s.
Wonderful. Well, that's all the time we have. Harold Meyerson, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your great political analysis.
Thank you, Eleanor. It's always a pleasure.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Many thanks to our research associate, Dr. Judith Singleton. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.